around practically as soon as they arrived. I took advantage of any opportunity to sneak away and check in on Shannon. The first time I went to the nursery, I was devastated by what I found. The person in charge was a kid, like me, just some random teenage Sea Org member on post who was hardly qualified to be taking care of children. Shannon was crying and soaked with urine in her crib. Before changing her and returning to my post, I vowed I wouldn't let her grow up this way. The neglect was overwhelming. I would immediately demand that the person on post clean up and change the babies. I would sometimes leave my post for a while to take Shannon out of there. I complained to my mother about it, and she complained to her seniors, who threatened that she would be taken off her job and demoted. She continued to voice her concerns about it, and they told her to write it up in a report. But nothing was ever done. It really weighed on me. Though I was buying into the program, it raised a question inside of me. While I didn't care so much about me, I wondered if we were doing right by this baby. It was at this time that my mother revealed that we had no home to return to. Dennis wasn't coming to join us after all. At first, he would make excuses that he could accumulate more money by staying behind, but ultimately, he had found someone else, gotten rid of our apartment, and moved on. He and Mom weren't together anymore. They were getting a divorce. Dennis, the man who claimed he would never do anything to harm us, who made us change our whole lives and live within the world of Scientology, who cheated on our mom while she was pregnant, had now left us. We were heartbroken. This hit us like a punch in the stomach. I knew even then that moving in with my dad and stepmother was not an alternative. The Sea Org and its practices may have been hard on us, but at my dad's house, my sisters and I would be called cunts, ingrates, and selfish assholes for crimes like pulling the laundry out before it was completely dry. Dad would tell Nicole and me over and over again throughout our childhood that he wasn't even sure if we were his real children because our mother was a slut. And on top of this, during the brief time we did spend with my dad, we lived in fear of his violent episodes. To us, the thought of living with him was worse than joining a cult. We realize now more than ever that we didn't have a choice but to stay in Florida. We had nowhere else to go. We couldn't leave our mom there to raise a baby on her own. Being in the Sea Org was what our mother wanted for us. And so though we worked long hours and lived in a filthy dorm, we were committed to staying by her side. "I promise you girls," Mom said, "it will get better." Chapter 3. Nicole and I were now put on post with the rest of the Sea Org. Like the adults, we worked 14-hour days and picked up the wonderful adult habits of drinking coffee and smoking cigarettes. One habit we didn't pick up was going to school regularly. LRH had deep disdain for the conventional educational system. Scientology abided by the idea that as long as you were on course, getting an education in Scientology, going to traditional school was not all that important. Your education in Scientology, the main goal of which was to teach you how to learn Scientology, was the imperative. We're taught that getting a Scientology education was the equivalent of getting a doctorate in the real world. Who cares about calculus when you're clearing the planet? So because attending school wasn't enforced, the motel room at Flag that was designated schoolroom was usually empty, and although I was still technically in eighth grade, I hardly ever went. At Flag, we did find moments to act like regular kids. Sherry and I played stupid pranks on the Sea Org boys, like putting shaving cream and Vaseline on the door handles in their dorm. We made them over and attempted to turn them into breakdancers in the lobby of the motel. We'd find little victories by using the hotel loudspeaker to page people at the Fort Harrison. "Mrs. Dickington, please come to reception," and then doubling over with laughter. During libs, a few hours off, or if you were lucky, a whole day off once every 2 weeks, we would take the bus with some of the other kids to the mall to walk around, even though we had no money to buy anything. During this time, Sherry and I would stay up late in our bunks and share our life stories. Sherry had grown up in the founding church of Scientology in Washington, D.C., where her mother and stepfather had been full-time staff members. Just a child herself, she was frequently left in charge of the babies and children in the daycare, often going on walks where she pushed two strollers at a time. Her brother, Stefan, had already joined the Sea Org a year earlier and was at Flag when recruiters from the New York Org came to D.C. to find new candidates for the Sea Org. With her parents' approval, the recruiters agreed to be Sherry's guardians. So at the age of 11, she was shipped to New York. All alone in a big, strange city, she was left to fend for herself. The recruiters were her guardians legally, but they did nothing to care for her. No one made sure I brushed my teeth or had a winter coat, she said. She'd been there only a week when an executive screamed at her. Sherry called her mom to ask if she can go home, but her mother said she needed to stick it out. This type of thinking becomes a parent's reality. Everything is about the church, the bigger picture. Parents refer back to policy for major and minor decisions, looking to the phrase, "What does LRH say?" to advise them. All this is part of doing something big here. After that, Sherry barely had any contact with her family. Phone calls and letters were rare, and she visited her mother and stepfather for only 1 week every other year. Her stepdad had taught her all these folk songs that she would sing for me at night. I fell asleep to "Where Have All the Flowers Gone," or "You Are My Sunshine," as I sucked on two fingers and held the blanket. Even though we were treated the same as adults, we were really just little girls. After being at Flag for a number of months, we had really gotten into the Sea Org rhythm. We got on the bus at 8 in the morning, were on post for the next 14 hours, smoked and drank coffee throughout, and developed systems for pretty much everything. I even had a system for dealing with our roach-infested dorm room. Turn on the lights and wait for them to scatter before you jump into your bed. Despite the long work days and specific procedurals, I found openings and made the system work for me. One of my tasks on post was to deduct bills from guest accounts, including their food tickets. We staffers were Sea Org members, but the guests were all regular parishioners who had come to participate in auditing and training. Sea Org members and regular parishioners, or the public, as we called them, ate different food in different places. We ate rice and beans night and day, or liquid eggs. They ate steak, lobster, roasted chicken, anything you can get in a normal hotel. We weren't supposed to fraternize with the public in the first place, but with our salary of $15 a week, we didn't have the money to eat at the hotel's restaurants anyway. My epiphany was that I was the person taking the tickets. That meant I could easily go into the Lemon Tree and the Hourglass, the public restaurants, or the canteen where they serve snack food, and order a chicken sandwich or a piece of chocolate cake under a phony account name. Then in a couple of days when my tickets came into the office, I could take them to my room, burn them, and flush the ashes down the toilet. And that's exactly what I started doing. I didn't tell a soul what I was up to, and I never got caught for my food scam. My attitude during this time was like, I gotta eat. I'm a Sea Org member, part of an elite group, and I'm clearing the planet, so get out of my way. I was being trained to make the impossible happen, rising above my own mental and physical limitations. I was feeling fierce. Having said that, I still had to live and operate within the very strict constraints of the Sea Org. Scientology is based on thousands of policies that leave no room for interpretation. Your actions are either on policy or off policy. One of the challenges Nicole and I had was keeping track of these many policies. There were so many, and they were so hard to keep straight that we didn't always know when we were breaking a rule. That's what happened one day when the two of us were walking through the building while on post. A girl around our age walking in front of us stopped when she got to a door, paused in front of it, and told us to open it for her. Are your arms broken? Nicole said. Open your own fucking door. I'm a messenger. What are you delivering? We had no idea that she was a member of the Commodore's Messenger Org, CMO, or even what that was. Well, we found out soon enough when we were routed to the Department of Inspections and Reports, otherwise known as Ethics, the department that deals with enforcing policy. Waiting for us in his office was a Master at Arms, MAA, essentially the person you were sent to when you were in trouble. Sort of like district parent. There are ethics officers throughout Scientology, and their job is to apply ethics technology to Scientologists at all levels. The MAA waiting for us walked around carrying a wooden stick, and his office was decorated with a picture of LRH and the bridge, like pretty much every other room. There he showed us an organizational board with all 21 departments that made up Scientology. At the very top, of course, was L. Ron Hubbard. So when you're talking to a messenger, you are talking to LRH, the MAA said. And when you're disrespectful to a messenger, you're being disrespectful to LRH. He showed us all these policies about messengers and said that from now on, we were to address all CMOs as sir or mister, no matter what their gender. My takeaway from the MAA speech was that being a CMO was the shit. On our way back to our berthing, I told Nicole that I was going to be a messenger. You're an asshole. I might be an asshole, but but you're still going to be calling me sir in about a minute. I made an appointment with the messenger recruitment office. The recruiter, reviewing my ethics folder, which contained reports on all my crimes, had a different take. My record showed that I had a problem with authority and flirted too much with boys. If you are pristine for 6 months, I will reevaluate you, he said. I accepted his review and vowed that he would see me again and that I would get in. A few days after the messenger incident, Nicole, my mom, and I were summoned to the ethics office in the CMO building. The ethics officer told me that he had a knowledge report that a friend of mine had written up about me. Knowledge reports are a system of Scientologists reporting on one another, basically setting up the idea that not telling on your friends bars their freedom as well as makes you an accessory to the crime. It's like systematic tattling. The report he had on me stated that Danny Burns, my first boyfriend, whom I claimed as soon as he arrived at Flag and kissed a lot, had touched my boobs over my blouse. Sex before marriage was forbidden for members of the Sea Org, as was heavy petting. But kissing was okay. In his office, the MEA told me what Danny and I had done was heavy petting and against policy. But he did it lightly, I said, confused. That only seemed to make the ethics officer even angrier. He told me to look at the reference in the policy and find the definition of heavy petting, which he made me recite back to him. Unbeknownst to me, the same friend had written a knowledge report about Nicole and her boyfriend that said they were having sex, which is even more serious than Danny touching my boobs. It also wasn't true. Nicole was like a nun about that stuff, and we were both still virgins. The MEA was sufficiently alarmed and called a code red. Two highly trained security officers of the church, a pair of 15-year-olds, launched an investigation into our so-called sexual perversions. They burst into our dorm room, rifled through our drawers, and found a pair of my underwear with a hint of lace, probably from Haynes Her Way, and a baby doll pajama top that belonged to Nicole. This was considered the evidence that my sister and I were sexually aberrated, a Scientology term that means wrong behavior or a departure from what's rational in a straight line. The ethics officer told my mother that he had no other choice but to send us both to the RPF. Nicole had been mouthing off to the MEA earlier and was being accused of upsetting him with her hostile communication. I guess fuck you could be interpreted that way. The mention of the RPF, the Rehabilitation Project Force, sent a chill down my spine. I knew what that was from seeing the RPF members in their musters, which were the formations we all had to assemble in at any Sea Org gathering. Beginning of day, end of meals, group announcements, you name it. We got in our proper musters for it. The RPF mustered separately from the rest of us, so they were easy to identify. In 110-degree Florida heat and humidity, these men, women, and even children were forced to wear all black from head to toe as they did heavy mess work. MESS is an acronym for matter, energy, space, and time. Like cleaning grease traps in the kitchen or scrubbing dumpsters. And that wasn't all they had to do for their spiritual rehabilitation. They also had to run everywhere they went, to the bathroom, to the galley, anywhere. They had virtually no liberties. As long as they were in the RPF, they worked pretty much 7 days a week, 365 days a year, and that's not including all the time spent doing security checks for their transgressions. No matter how high they had been in the organization before, once they landed in the RPF, they had to call everyone, even EPFers, the lowest form of Sea Org, sir. And they were not allowed to speak unless spoken to. The RPF was the ultimate form of punishment, and your time there could last for months or even years, during which you basically weren't even considered a person. Absolutely not, Mom said. My girls aren't going to the RPF. The MEA stared at my mother, and she stared right back with her green eyes that could be childlike or very, very hard. In that moment, she reverted from her acquiescent Scientologist self back to the Brooklyn survivor. My sister and I were frozen as we watched the silent standoff between the two adults to see who was going to win. My mother requested a fitness board, referring to a council that could determine our fitness as members of the Sea Org. We had heard this was a way to get out of the Sea Org without too many repercussions. The council would eventually ask the question, "Are you here on your own determinism?" And you would respond, "No," and be told to leave. Shortly thereafter, we began packing. Sherry, who had been asked by an ethics officer to write up a report on anything she knew about my physical relationship with Danny, was sad to see me go, and I was sad to say goodbye to her. but she wasn't surprised. You have a strong personality, and they don't want that in the Sea Org. You're more trouble than you're worth, she said. I'm surprised you lasted as long as you did. Chapter 4. We were on the 405, the very last bit of the drive that had taken several days from Clearwater to Los Angeles, when after heading up a mountain, we suddenly saw a sea of lights spread out below us. My first real vision of L.A. With my sister and me facing the prospect of being thrown into the RPF, Mom knew we had to leave Clearwater. Despite everything that had happened, my mom still very much believed in Scientology and our family's place in it, and so did I. In moving to L.A. and joining up with other Scientologists, we look forward to the security of this larger group, a real community. Even though Nicole and I didn't make it in the Sea Org, that didn't mean we didn't have a place in clearing the planet. And like all Scientologists, we didn't want our eternity threatened. We learned pretty early on that we come back again and again over the course of millions and millions of years, as the body is just the vessel for the Phaeton spirit. We didn't have much money, but thankfully, a friend of my mother's from Brooklyn, who now lived in Los Angeles, offered to take us in. A Scientologist herself, she said the church was really strong out there. L.A. has the greatest concentration of Scientologists in the world. California was nothing like what Nick and I thought it was going to be. We had pictured L.A. as a beach town filled with blonde people in bikinis. But Hollywood, where we were staying, felt like just another big city. Where's the damn water, Nicole asked. I was just as disappointed as Nick that L.A. wasn't straight out of a scene from Baywatch, but I was still excited to be there. I could hardly wait to start fulfilling my dreams of being an actress. My mom's friend and her husband let us sleep on the floor of their apartment. We now included baby Shannon, Mom's new boyfriend George, whom she had met in Clearwater, and his two teenage sons. The tiny apartment was a block from the Blue Buildings, a gigantic complex of 10 buildings that made up the Church of Scientology's West Coast headquarters. The imposing concrete Art Deco building was the former Cedars of Sinai Hospital, erected on Fountain Avenue in the 1920s. It is known as Big Blue because of the color it was painted after being acquired by the church in 1977. By the time we arrived in California, I should have technically been in the ninth grade, but because I missed an entire year of school while in Florida, I was enrolled at King Junior High School. Not very inspired to return to school, Nicole and I persuaded our mother to let us quit. She felt, as do most Scientologists, that studying Scientology is more important than getting a traditional education. So as long as we were on course, my mom was okay with it. Plus, I would say things like, Ma, I'm going to be an actress. I'll hire an accountant who went to school, I promise. Now that we were no longer enrolled in school, we immediately set out to get jobs. Everyone in our family was hustling to find work since we all needed to chip in to eat, pay the electricity bill, make car payments, and stay on course. Our religion didn't come free. The courses Nick and I were taking were still introductory, so they weren't expensive compared to what it cost to do more advanced courses. Still, the range of $45 to $300 per course was a fortune for us. Plus, I was starting with a deficit. After I left the Sea Org, I was saddled with what's called a freeloader's debt. Sea Org members take courses for free in exchange for being on post, but if you leave of your own volition or are thrown out or found unfit, you owe the church money for those free courses you took while in the Sea Org. I owed thousands for the courses I took in Clearwater. I wasn't allowed to be on course again until I paid my debt, so I went on a payment plan. Practicing Scientology imposed a lot of financial pressure on everybody, but it also opened opportunities to make money. In businesses run by Scientologists, lack of experience, age, or education didn't seem to matter. The kind of training provided by being on course was good enough. So after my mom found a job at a solar heating company, American Sun, which was run by Scientologists, I begged her to find me work there as well. And unbelievably, she did. It was a telemarketing position where the barrier of entry was pretty low, but still, since I was just a teenager, the job was nothing short of a miracle. My job was to call people who were listed in a huge binder and to stick to a script that went something like this. Me. Hello, sir, ma'am. I am calling to congratulate you on winning an all-expense-paid trip to Laughlin, Nevada. All you have to do is have a representative from American Sun come out for you to retrieve your certificate. Customer, what's the catch? There is no catch, sir, ma'am. You simply need to set an appointment for someone to come out and enlighten you on how solar heating could drastically cut your cooling and heating bills down. After you listen to a 90-minute presentation on solar heating for your home, You will receive this trip at no cost to you. We have a rep in your area tomorrow afternoon on another appointment. Does that work for you? Even I thought this was a racket, but my boss assured me it was the real thing. The free trip was from Tuesday to Thursday, and it was to Laughlin, which apparently was the fucked up part of Nevada, where they have $2.99 buffets and penny slots. But it was real, and it was free. So I took my seat in a large room of rows and rows of telemarketers and looked up at a big board on the wall. On it was every telemarketer's name, including mine, with little suns that represented how many confirmed appointments each caller had made. While I was going to get suns all across the board, yeah, I was definitely going to rock this. I dialed my first number with total confidence that came to me both from my inherent personality and from what I had learned in Scientology. There is simply no in Scientology. "Hello, ma'am," I began. When it came time for the woman to say, "What's the catch?" she actually said it. Even though my boss told me they always said it, I couldn't believe it actually worked. But when I got to the part about setting up an appointment, the lady on the other end of the line didn't go for it. No problem. There were more names where hers came from. By the end of the day, however, I realized that booking appointments wasn't as easy as I thought it would be. In fact, I hadn't booked a single appointment all day. When the next day didn't go any better, I decided to take matters into my own hands and go off script. Mostly, the people I called cut the conversation short by hanging up on me. So when one man did just that, I called him back to give him the real talk. "Hey, it's me again," I said. "Listen, you do have to sit through this boring thing on solar heating, but you don't need to buy it. Just, like, do the presentation and you literally get a trip. It's Tuesday through Thursday, okay? But it seems like you aren't that busy." He hung up on me again. And then I called him again. This time, I didn't care about making a freaking appointment. I wanted to give him a piece of my mind. "What is this? What are you, some kind of animal?" I shouted, sounding like my dad. "You don't hang up on people." The man hung up again and then called the company to file a complaint about me. Not only did I never get a single son by my name, I soon got fired. I wasn't so upset when American Son let me go because by that point, I realized there was a whole network of Scientology businesses in the vicinity of the blue buildings, which was important since I didn't have a car. My sister got a job down the street at a place called George's General Store, which sold accessories needed for Scientology sessions and recommended vitamins. Canvassing the area around Fountain Avenue, I went into the restaurant right across from the blue buildings, New York George's, no connection to the general store. My strategy was to use the fact that I was from New York to get my foot in the door. The owner, Randy, a Scientologist, interviewed me and agreed to try me out as a cashier because I wasn't trusted to be a waitress with the attitude I had on me, as he could attest to from my days as a customer there. "Just sit here on the stool, take the money, make change, and try not to lose us any business with your mouth," Randy said. "Can I at least—" "No," Randy said. "Take the money, make the change, and that is it." To pass the time, rather than just sit there, I took it upon myself to clean the doors every 5 minutes with Windex, clean the cash register with a Q-tip, and put all the bills facing in one direction. You could say I had an obsession with things looking neat and clean, and I still do. Eventually, Randy promoted me to waitress, a job that I know most people complain about, but I absolutely loved it. I mimicked my grandmother, who used to clean the whole table after we finished dinner and before coffee and cake. "You don't want to sit in macaroni," she'd say. "Let me make it nice." So before I served the coffee, with the napkin in between the saucer and the cup, naturally, I'd say, "Let me make it nice," and then I'd clean the table, which customers found charming. I even loved being a waitress when customers were busting my balls, an occupational hazard. One of my regular customers was a guy named John Futris, who owned a Scientology graphic design company called JFI a few doors down. They printed all of the church's literature. John was always smiling, but he was a pain in the ass with his muffin ordering. "I'd like a blueberry muffin with the top cut off, but not in half. The top should be smaller. And then I want two pats of butter, one on top of the other one in the second half. But make sure the butter's not frozen, so warm it in your hand first. Then a coffee with half and half and one sugar every day." This went on for a couple months until one day when John asked me what I really wanted to do, I told him eventually I wanted to be an actress, but my immediate goal was to make more money. "I believe you'll be a great actress one day," he said, before asking me if I typed and wanted a job that paid more. "Yes, and yes," I said. I quit New York George's that day. I was moving up in the world, going corporate. I only prayed that my eyes would go bad so I could wear glasses, which would go perfectly with the pencil skirts I planned to wear. John called me into his office on my first morning and said, I need you to take this down in shorthand because I need you to type up a letter. Yep. I wrote down what he said, sort of, and went back to my desk to type it up. I sat and stared down at the typewriter. I didn't know how to type. Didn't really even know how to load in the paper. I could have sworn I took a class in school once. Or was that in a movie I saw? Whatever. How hard could this be? An hour later, John called me on the intercom and said, is that letter ready to be signed? Looking at the catastrophe that was the letter, I'd used about a half a bottle of whiteout, I knew I couldn't show it to him. So as I walked into his office and looked at him sitting behind his big wooden desk, I said, John, I lied to you. I can't type. And I started to tear up. Honey, you lied about typing? Why? Because you're from Chicago and I just really wanted to work for you. And Lee, you're so cute. John fired me as his secretary. He did offer me another job as his personal assistant. My first task was to go up to his house on Mulholland Drive and bring his shirts to the cleaners. Easy enough. But I was bewitched by his Greek wife, Valerie, with her blonde hair and her long, pretty nails. Valerie was also from New York, and she laughed at everything I said. She was always pinching my cheeks and saying, you're so cute. Who wouldn't be smitten? It was so hard to believe hours had gone by. John fired me as his assistant and hired me as his accounts receivable person, where I was given a crash course in getting people to pay their bills. While I may have failed him as a secretary and as an assistant, I quickly learned the art of manipulating people into paying their bills on time, all the while using church tactics to find their weaknesses and prey on them. When I wasn't working, I would hang out with a bunch of kids around Nick's and my age whose parents were Sea Org members, but who themselves no longer wanted anything to do with the Sea Org and Scientology. As I mentioned, in Scientology, minors are considered spiritual beings and not children in need of protection and guidance. You are the only one responsible for the condition of your life, regardless of your age. The Sea Org members believed that their kids could make up their own minds. As a result, these kids could no longer live with their parents, most of whom had berthing in the blue buildings. Even if that meant they ended up practically squatting or sleeping in a stranger's apartment, their parents felt that it was the child's decision to make. They weren't running away from a home where a mother and father worried about them. Nicole and I were compassionate, and we hung out with these kids. They got us, meaning they knew the ways of Scientology, even if they chose to leave it, and we, like them, had basically said, fuck you to the Sea Org, if not to Scientology. Shouldn't we be friends with these people and set a good example for others? So, with everyone basically left to their own devices, some kids lived with other regular Scientology parishioners in the neighborhood. Others buddied up and moved into their own apartments with one Scientology kid or kids old enough to sign a lease, or kids live with complete strangers if need be. We spent our days working, our evenings going on course, and our nights together smoking, playing gym rummy, and scrounging for jobs, even food. Hanging out in front of Hannon's, which was a local mini-mart, at the corner of Edgemont and Fountain, we formed a tight-knit community. We were children trying to be adults. Whenever we met someone who was struggling in his or her life, be it with drugs or alcohol or other addictions, we were convinced we could save them with Scientology. It didn't matter if they were twice our age or battling demons we couldn't begin to understand. We thought we had the knowledge and skills to help. During this time, I wavered between acting like a typical teenager and like someone who thought she was a spiritual being. I carried on with friends and partied and drank, thinking, I have all the answers in the world. Nothing's going to harm me. I would walk in at 3 a.m. after a night out and hear my mother say, what the fuck? Why is it okay for you to come in at 3 a.m.? Who cares, I'd say. I care. You still live under my roof. One morning, my mother found me at home instead of on course. She asked me why I wasn't at church. I told her that I had been drinking, and so I couldn't go on course. Scientology policy states that you're not allowed to be on course within 24 hours of drinking. She started yelling at me, and I laid into her about how I work, I go on course, am I a spiritual being or not? According to Scientology, we are all equals. What are you going to do, wait for my body to turn 21? I tried to use Scientology against her, and she responded less as a Scientologist and more as a mom. Don't use that shit against me, Lee. I'm still your mother. Later that day, she filed a knowledge report on me. When I showed up on chorus the day after that, my supervisor summoned me almost immediately, took out an ethics routing form and wrote my name on it. It was a printed form that directed me to proceed to the ethics office. I had fucked up. I was off to see an MAA, who is just one of a whole network of ethics officers in Hollywood, working in concert to investigate and make sure everyone was in ethics. In other words, they were on our shit. The only thing required of us was that we stay on course, and the only people we had to answer to were Scientology officials. "What's happening?" asked the MAA, a heavyset woman with curly black hair. "Why didn't you make it to course yesterday?" "Oh, I was tired," but the MAA didn't buy it. And she employed an investigative technique called pull a string. The piece of string sticking out represents something that doesn't make sense, like the idea that I wouldn't come to course because I was tired. Further questioning is pulling on a string, finding out why I was tired, and this MAA was going to keep pulling until she got to the bottom of it. "Why were you tired?" "I'm not sure." "Why were you out late?" "What's late to you?" "What's late to you?" "Like 2 a.m. "What do you do until 2 a.m.? "Hang out." "Does hanging out mean doing drugs?" "No." "Is anyone who you're hanging out with doing drugs?" "I don't know." I was starting to grow more anxious. "Well, because you can't be connected to that, right? So if you're connected to that, you see how that has a domino effect in your life? You didn't make it to course, right? Things don't just happen. Everything has a cause and effect." "I didn't do drugs. I wouldn't do that." "Good, because they are the single most destructive element to a person's spiritual and mental well-being." "I drank." The MAA sat back and looked at me straight in the eye. Wasn't accusatory, but instead kind of calming. "Good. So who else was involved?" she asked. I quickly reverted from peaceful back to worried. I didn't want to get my friends in trouble. As if she could read my mind, the MAA said, "It's not about tattling, Leah. You know what the policy says. You're not narking on them. You're helping them. Is it great that they're staying out and getting drunk till 2 in the morning? "No, I guess not." "So what's the greatest good here? Is to tell the truth. And if we all did that, we'd all be helping each other to live a better life. It's about not being a WOG." A term for a non-Scientologist, short for well and orderly gentleman. WOGs are considered to be ignorant and unenlightened and to be avoided for their lack of priorities. The MAA scribbled as quickly as the names rolled off my tongue. She was connecting the dots for a knowledge report. Every person I mentioned would be routed to ethics. But I didn't feel guilty. I felt relieved. I had given up my transgressions and I was helping my friends. But I did make a pact with myself. I'm going to be better. I'm going to be good. I'm going to be on course. I didn't want to be average. I didn't want to be acting like a WOG. I am more than this. I'm a Scientologist, and I'm here to help clear the planet. Chapter 5. It didn't take living in LA for long before I realized that you didn't actually need to be in anything to say that you were an actor. I would meet people all the time who said, "I'm an actor. What are you in?" "Well, right now I'm in the fry station at McDonald's." "I got it. You didn't actually have to do shit to be an actor. You didn't even have to necessarily believe in yourself. You just had to have the confidence to say it out loud." An acting job represented a way out of poverty for my family and me. It's a dream a lot of people have when they come to LA, but I felt particularly responsible to change our living conditions for the better. After we slept on my mom's friend's floor in Hollywood for a while, we moved into a house on Los Feliz in Edgemont that looked like a mansion from the outside, but inside was a dump. Nicole and I had to sleep in the dining room. We had no money for furniture, my sister had 2 jobs. Everyone was working so hard to contribute toward our food, housing, and Scientology. It was an exhausting life, and all I could think about was moving us up and out. I also felt I had to be something bigger than a SEWG member to ever regain respect after being a deserter. So I thought the only way to do so was to become a celebrity, or what Scientology calls an opinion leader, one who is persuasive and whose opinion matters. If I wanted to do more than just call myself an actor, I needed an agent. Even I knew that. So I talked to Sherry, who is now dating actress Juliette Lewis's brother Lightfield, about getting me an agent. Sherry had left Flag and the Sea Org about a year after I did, returning home to D.C., where she got a part-time job at a copy shop and did some door-to-door sales. She wasn't in school, and she and her mother weren't getting along. We kept in touch, and I knew how unhappy she was, so I told her to come meet me in New York when I went back to visit my dad, and once there, I convinced her to come live with us in L.A. George, whom my mom had now married, partitioned off a room within our living room for her, and I got her a job waitressing at New York George's and then at John's Printing Company. Sherry was eager to help me, and as promised, Liefeld introduced me to an agent, albeit a children's agent. Natalie Rawson was everything I expected her to be, an older lady with coiffed blonde hair, a lot of bracelets, and an office in the valley. So, do you have any experience? Nah, zero. But I was talking to my friend who, well, okay, you need to lose that accent? Yeah, totally. I'm not going to sign you just yet because you're a little right off the boat. I'll send you out on a few auditions to see how you do, but don't run around saying I'm your agent. No problem, Nat. And don't call me Nat. Yep. My first audition was for a soap opera. Liefeld talked to me about what to expect. He knew a lot about the business from his family. His sister would later go on to success with films such as California and Natural Born Killers. Their dad, Jeffrey Lewis, was a veteran TV and film character actor and a big Scientologist. Liefeld explained that I needed to get the sides. Sides are a portion of a script that you are expected to perform at auditions. He wanted me to familiarize myself with the material. In the soap opera audition, one of my lines was, "Do you think I'm a whore?" In my Brooklyn accent, whore sounded like hua. Pointing to the line, the kid's director asked, "What is this word you're saying?" "Hua?" I asked. "What's that?" she asked. "It's a girl who has sex with guys for money." "No, I'm asking, in what language are you attempting to speak?" I laughed. She did not. My non-agent, Natalie, called and had these words to say. "It is not going any further." I said, "I don't know what that means. Are we breaking up?" "No, I'm telling you that you didn't get the part." Next, I was sent to see Bob Korf, one of the top voice coaches in the business. After we had worked together for one session, Bob said, "You know, I'm going to go against what your agent's saying. I think you should keep your accent. Your personality is going to get you where you want to go, and your accent is part of that." "Bob," I said, "I couldn't agree with you more." Natalie next set up a meeting with a casting director named John Levy. He would go on to cast a number of popular shows like China Beach and ER. But most importantly for me, at the time, he was casting Head of the Class, the ABC sitcom about a class of kids in an honors program at a public high school in Manhattan. My plan was this: get on the show, meet Brian Robbins, who played the character Eric, and have him fall in love with me. He was from Marine Park, Brooklyn, which was just a couple of miles along King's Highway from Bensonhurst, so it was destiny. We'd get married and be a power celebrity couple who never forgot our roots. During this time, I had been working at Survival Insurance, a Scientologist-owned company where I assisted insurance brokers. I headed out at lunch and spent money that was supposed to be for my car payment on a cute mini and a white tee at the $5 clothing store and a brand new pair of Skippies from the Payless next door. I figured that once I got the part on Head of the Class, I would make all the payments that I had missed on my new car. So, it would all work out. I drove over to the Warner Brothers lot to meet John Levy. Not knowing how it worked, I assumed that once he approved me, I would be sent to the set to marry Brian. I mean, to work on the show. This was my second audition, and my agent hadn't given me any sides. Instead, I planned to charm John with my whole tough girl shtick, turning into a full-on cousinette as soon as I got in front of him. With my Brooklyn accent thicker than usual, my hands waving all around and a lot of fuck sprinkled in, I started talking about how this one's a jerk-off and that one's a jerk-off in Hollywood. I had this big casting director laughing at my act, and in my mind, the deal was done. Get the director's chair ready with my name written on the back, I was in. "You're adorable," John said. "Go outside for a minute, look at the sides, and then come back in to read." "Oh, there's more to this?" "Yeah, honey. You've got to audition." I was confused. I thought I had been auditioning, but I didn't say anything. I walked out into the lobby, only to return a few minutes later. As I started reading the sides with John, I became a different girl. My smile wobbled, my hand shook so badly that the script made a rustling noise and my voice cracked. I went from sassy to loser in 2 seconds flat. It was like having an out-of-body experience. I could see it happening to me, but there was nothing I could do to stop it. The audition did not last long. You are so damn cute. You're just a little new at auditioning, so I'm not having you come back tomorrow for producers because you're very green. Don't worry, though. I know you now, and I'm going to keep you in my pocket. I'm going to call you, I promise. But I did worry. I walked out of the studio defeated. I had blown it, my big chance to be an actress, marry Brian slash Eric, and be a big star in my family's eyes and to the church, to get out of poverty and live happily ever after it was squashed, as well as be on TV. Oh, and make that car payment, or payments. But by the time I got to my car, parked across the street in the Taco Bell parking lot, I was back to being a fighter. Fuck that. I called information from the Taco Bell payphone and asked for the Warner Brothers casting department. Hi, I said when I got the secretary of John Levy's office on the line. I was just there. I gotta tell John something. Can I talk to him real fast? Miraculously, she put me through. What's up, he asked, and I began crying. I'm sorry, I was so nervous. I didn't know. I thought I already had the job. I could do better. Please give me another chance. I was nervous. I was not prepared. I don't know if it was because I was crying so hard and he felt sorry for me or what, but John said, okay, come back tomorrow at 4. There's a producer session. Maybe you'll do better. Oh, I definitely do better. I thanked John for the second chance, told him I wouldn't let him down, and then called my agent's office, where I left word with her assistant about what had happened. I was pretty pleased with myself until later that day when I got a call from my agent screaming at me. If you ever harass a casting director again, she yelled. Wait a minute. He told you I harassed him? You listen to me. You don't call them directly. That's not the way it's done here in Hollywood. You got it? If you pull a stunt like this again, I'm going to drop you so fast. John Levy was the biggest jerk-off in the history of Hollywood. For him to call my agent and say I was harassing him after he told me how fucking cute I was, when I made it big, I was going to thank John Levy for being such an asshole, publicly, while accepting an Emmy. I had it all planned out. And lastly, I'd like to thank John Levy, jerk-off of all jerk-offs, for being a two-faced. I was at work the next day when the phone rang around 5 in the afternoon. Survival Insurance, this is Leah, can I help you? Leah, it's John Levy. Why didn't you show up at your appointment? I didn't even let him finish the sentence before I started in. You asshole, I thought you were going to be my buddy. Instead, you complained to my agent that I'm harassing you. What kind of dick fuck? John told me to shut up and went on to say that he never said anything like that to my agent. He explained that he had called Natalie's office the day before to confirm the appointment and let her know that there would be more people in the room so that I'd be prepared. He had told her assistant what I had done to get back in the room with him. Look, he said, your agent said that because you had the balls to call me, and I'm telling you now, I don't want you to change, Leah. Don't listen to her or people like her. You did what your heart told you to do, and I hope you always do. Thank you, John, I said. Yeah, no problem. Sorry about calling you an asshole. No worries. And a dick. Okay, honey, I gotta go. And also, fuck, hello? Okay, guess you had to go. But head of the class wasn't going any further. Still, he made good on his promise that he would keep me in mind for any part he thought I'd be right for. He was my champion, calling me once a week for auditions where invariably I got nervous as soon as I got in front of the producers. Don't turn into an asshole when you get into the room, John would say while walking me down the hallway in the studio for my audition. You're the asshole. You get crazy when you get in there. You get weird and you start rambling. I want you to shut the fuck up, he said, right before opening the door to the room where the producers were waiting. As soon as we stepped inside, his entire demeanor shifted. Beaming a huge smile at the suits, he said, hello, this is Leah Remini. You're going to love her. Well, they didn't love me. Instead, what I got from that audition and dozens, if not hundreds more, was, it's not going any further. And an all-new rejection, they went another way. Apparently, my car wasn't going to go any further either. Side note, when the Ford Motor Credit guy tells you that you're behind in payments 90 days and they're going to repossess your car, they mean it. Despite the fact that you went out of your way to make them laugh, my car was repossessed shortly thereafter, making getting to auditions, where I would lose roles, all that much harder. Each time I went to an audition, my mom would say, I know you're going to get this part, and each time I had to come home and tell her that I didn't. That we were going to eat Taco Bell again for dinner, that we couldn't buy furniture. While my mother never discouraged me, it broke my heart having to face up to this failure in her eyes. It killed me that I couldn't help my family and that we were living this way. I understood this failure of not landing any of the roles I auditioned for to be 100% my fault. According to Scientology, I either wasn't applying the technology I was learning well enough, or I wasn't applying it correctly. Clearly, I wasn't dedicated enough, because if I were, I would have the job. I equated my struggles as an actress with punishment for my behavior. So I was always trying to be a better Scientologist, believing that the technology would provide the assurance for success. The more I worked in the church, the more success I would have in my career. This was the mantra we were taught. I heard over and over how the more successful a person was, the more impact he or she could have for the church. I thought I could also make more change happen in the world if I were famous. I pictured myself one day on the cover of Celebrity, Scientology's answer to People magazine. In this way, my two goals of advancing as a Scientologist and as an actress became intertwined. My mom's attitude was that if I wanted to be an actress badly enough, you'll make it go right. That's a widely used phrase that hints at a major concept running throughout Scientology. Either you are an able being, meaning someone who can overcome any obstacle to achieve a goal, or you are simply an average person who can't make it happen. I couldn't be average. I didn't give up, either in the church or as an actress. And finally, I was rewarded with something good. John Levy wore the producers down until they agreed to give me a small walk-on part and my first line on none other than Head of the Class. It was 1988 when I arrived on the set of my favorite show. It was the first time I'd been on a comedy set. Instantly, I knew I was home. The smell of the stage, the heat from the lights, the energy from the audience when they cheered each cast member. And then when an actor got that first laugh, that sound was a drug. I want this. I want to make people feel this. I knew I had to make an impression, even though I had a pretty nondescript part. I was in a scene where three girls walk by Eric, my future hubby. The first says, "Hi, Eric, 3 o'clock, don't forget," and walks off stage. The next girl, "Hi, Eric, 3:30, don't forget." And finally me, "Hi, Eric, 3:40, don't forget." How was I going to separate myself from the other girls with that one line? I decided to add a dramatic pause and a wink. When it was my turn, I took a deep breath and went for it. "Hi, Eric," pause, "3:40, wink, don't forget." "Cut," the director said. "That's great. Now, can you cut all that other stuff you're doing and just say your line and walk off like everybody else, okay, doll?" Doll, that's cute. Maybe he wasn't really seeing the magic before him. I would do it one more time. After all, he called me doll. I cut the wink, but I kept the dramatic pause. "What did I tell you about all that other shit you're adding in there? Just say your line and get out." "Okay, will do." So I cut the wink and the pause and added only a little look back at the end, like one of those you do when you see if a guy's checking you out. "Let's take a camera break here," he said. "Cool," I thought. "They see the magic before them. I think they will have a meeting now and discuss how to add me into the show." The director called John Levy to the set. "Are you deaf or just annoying?" John said to me when he arrived. "They want to recast you because you're so annoying. You're not taking direction. You got to listen. This is not your moment. Steven Spielberg's not going to see this episode ahead of the class." He was right, and it wasn't going any further. Chapter 6. It was the fall of 1988 when I learned about the part of a sassy girl from Brooklyn with a heart of gold for a potential new sitcom. Sitting at my desk at Survival Insurance, where unfortunately I was still working, I took down information for my audition from my agent on the phone. Writing the description for the character Charlie Briscoe and the name of the show Living Dolls on the front of a weekly memo for the Monday night meeting I always tried to get out of. ABC and Columbia Pictures Television wanted a spinoff of Who's the Boss, the popular show starring Tony Danza as a retired baseball player turned housekeeper. The way the Living Dolls spinoff was set up was that Charlie is the best friend of Samantha, Alyssa Milano, from her old neighborhood. Charlie runs away from home, naturally, and goes to Samantha's house, where she is discovered by a modeling agent played by Michael Learnard, the mom from the Waltons, who, wowed by Charlie's beauty, decides not only to make her a model, but also have her come live with her and a few other models. The breakdown for the character of Charlie Briscoe was a teen with a smart mouth, a sense of humor, a New York accent, and a heart of gold. When I heard that, I told my mom, "This part is perfect for me. If I don't get this part, Mom, I don't think I'm going to act anymore." "What's the show about?" she asked. "Models." Who are you going to play? While I knew that I was right for the part and I could do the job, I was still nervous. I was really counting on this role in the series to change my life. Creator Ross Brown and executive producer Phyllis Glick had me work on a scene a few times. Whatever they saw, they liked it enough for me to get a call back. But right before I left, the cast director gave me a piece of advice for when I returned. Look like a model. Thanks, genius. Let me do that real quick. Should I also wish for 8 more inches of height and higher cheekbones? I can't be taller and prettier than I am, I said. Listen, sweetheart, when you come back, wear some makeup. Right, good note. I could put on makeup no problem, but the bigger issue was my nerves. As my time with John Levy showed, I was always great one-on-one or schmoozing a room. However, the minute I was standing in front of all those producers with those sides in my hands, I became a wreck. In a few days, I was going to have my network session for Living Dolls. I could already picture all those suits and the shaking script in my hand. After pretending to work at Survival, just killing time, I walked into the apartment I shared with my family and found my mom and a group of strangers waiting for me. They were all Scientologists. My mother introduced me to Bob, a friend of hers from the church who was a self-proclaimed acting manager. She had approached him about my problem and asked if he could help me prepare for my big audition for ABC. You need to get comfortable reading in front of a crowd, he said. Bob had me do some exercises straight out of the Scientology Success Through Communication course. It was intended to teach participants how to speak with intention and purpose. I worked from my sides. Flunk, he said whenever he couldn't hear me. Next, Bob had me do the sides in different tones along the tone scale. That's a Scientology concept of the successive emotional tones a person can experience, with a tone being the momentary or continuing emotional state of a person. The scale runs from 40.0 at the top, which is known as serenity of beingness, through body death at 0.0, all the way down to 40.0 total failure. Church policy states that if you are below 2.0 antagonism, you are a detriment to yourself and others. Scientologists do drills so they can learn to tell where people are on the tone scale and can stay clear of people who go below a certain point on that scale. Bob felt that actors needed to learn their lines in all tones of the scale so they could find the tone the character was in. Do it in hostility, Bob ordered me. I tried. I didn't get that, he said. I tried again. Now do it in numb. Not enough intention, was Bob's response to my effort. We went on like this for another 2 hours. At the producer session for Living Dolls the next day, I was bolstered by not only the rigorous drills that Bob had put me through, but also the support of a whole Scientology community that had come out to encourage me while I did the work. No one could take that away, not even the casting agent, who introduced me to the producers this way. Okay, the next actress is not a Brooke Shields, but she gets the material. She's fresh from New York and very funny. I worked the room the minute I got inside. Don't blow it, Remini. And just like in every good made-for-TV movie, I nailed it. My audition was good enough that I convinced the suits I could play a model. If that's not acting, I don't know what is. I was so grateful to the Scientology technology that made it happen and the members of my church who rallied around me. After 5 excruciating days, my non-agent, Natalie, called, and as I went to pick up the phone, I was thinking, please don't say it's not going any further, or that they went another way. Please change my life. Please change my life. I don't want to have a picnic table as a dining table. I don't want to scrounge for car payments anymore. Please, I've been good. I've been on course. Okay, I am cheating on my boyfriend, but I'll give that up tomorrow in session. Please give us a better life. Please work, Scientology. All that in the seconds it took for Natalie to say, you got your first series. I was hysterical, screaming, crying, cursing, and further she said, I'm going to need you to come to my office and sign contracts, not for the series. But she had finally decided to officially take me on as a client and be my agent. At 18 years old, I felt this was going to be the ticket out for my entire family. Mom, George, Nicole, Shannon, and I had lived in 7 apartments since moving to Los Angeles, and each was just as disgusting as the last. But now I can finally say, I'm an actress, a real one. I would finally make my family proud and the church proud. I gave notice at Survival Insurance by sending out a company-wide memo announcing, my fellow co-workers of Survival Insurance, I bid you all adieu. Even those who didn't believe in me, I'm off to be a big star. Please feel free to take my clients. A few wrote back via interoffice mail. Break a leg. When do you leave? You owe me money. I thought you were fired a long time ago. I didn't even know you worked here. Leah, you never had any clients. I had a new set of coworkers, my castmates, and I loved all the girls. Allison Elliott, Vivica Fox. Right after the pilot, she was replaced with Halle Berry. Oh shit, we were replaceable. And Deborah Tucker. The producers wanted us to have fun and bond as well as look great, so they treated us to personal training sessions and haircuts at a fancy Beverly Hills salon. Getting the star treatment was more glamorous and exciting than anything I could have ever imagined. I also felt strangely comfortable with it. Like, yeah, this is where I belong. But my real training for dolls was on the set of Who's the Boss? Before I was transformed into a fashion model with my own series, I had 2 weeks on the set of Who's the Boss, working with seasoned actors like Judith Light and Katherine Hellman. But no one was more influential for me during that crash course in how to be a sitcom star than Tony Danza. Tony taught me the importance of turning the page before the next line so you don't ruin the rhythm of a joke. Because there's nothing worse than if someone else has a joke and you're like, hold on a second, hold, while you fumble with the pages. And always say hello to your crew. Always know their names. And make eye contact. Tony was big time all about the crew and any people who became part of the set. He told me that it was important to introduce yourself to the guest cast, make them feel at home. Don't ignore people. Tony was very warm and efficient. He was strict in the way that he ran his set, which I learned when I broke one of his cardinal rules. Never keep an audience waiting. Throughout a TV show taping before a live audience, actors often have quick changes when you have to change outfits for another scene. Because the dressing rooms aren't usually located on the stage, there are quick change rooms backstage, which are basically structures made of felt held together by a clamp with an actor's name and tape on it. On my first day, as I was walking to the quick change room for wardrobe change, Tony stopped me. You can't be walking, he said. There are 250 people waiting out there, and once the audience is tired, that's it. There's no people laughing at your joke. This isn't about you. You have to think about the audience. You've got to run. After the show, he took me aside. You know why I'm hard on you, right? He said. Because you have it, and you could be great. I got to teach you these things now so you don't get yourself into bad habits. Tony was very loving and giving in a fatherly way. He was the one who taught me right from wrong on a sitcom set. And after my time on Who's the Boss, I wanted to be just like him. I wanted to talk to my cameraman, be gracious to my guest stars, and run my ass off for my quick changes. I wanted to follow his beautiful example. Why not be nice and courteous? Working on a sitcom is the best job you could ever have. It's very similar to a play where you rehearse, and then you perform it in front of a live audience. From the cameraman to props to wardrobe, everybody's excited when it's showtime. You rehearse all week on an empty stage with no audience, running through the show for the director, then for the writers, then writers and producers, and writers, producers, studio, and the network just for cameras. But on show night, the audience loads in, the DJ plays the music, the comic starts to warm up the audience. You can hear them laughing or not while you're backstage in hair and makeup or your dressing room. Your camera guys and girls are dressed up a little bit more, and there's just an extra something in the air. The audience is there to see you. You. Magic. Being on TV also meant that I could make more of an impact as a Scientologist. Even though I didn't get any special pass from my supervisor, who on the news of learning about my new gig asked me what my course schedule was going to be. Well, I can't be here at all on Friday because I'm filming, I said. So you'll have to make up the time on Saturday then, he said. If being a practicing Scientologist was hard before I became a regular on TV, after I started on Living Dolls, it was crazy. After a 12-hour day on set when everyone else was headed home to flop into bed or on their way out to dinner, I had to go to the church to spend 2.5 hours on course. Still, there wasn't any part of me that was unhappy. When I got the part, I immediately moved Mom, George, Shannon, and myself into a 3-bedroom apartment in Burbank. My mom, like a lot of Scientologists who put most of their resources towards Scientology rather than themselves, was the kind of person to get a secondhand couch or keep a dress forever. Meanwhile, I was working very hard not to be that kind of Scientologist. The conditions we had been living in embarrassed me, just like they had when I was a kid. And just like when I was in Brooklyn, I knew that if I was going to get what I wanted, matching furniture, normal snacks, coffee cups with saucers, I had to make it happen. I believed that I would be the one to move us up and out. My family was now going to live a better life, and I was going to be the one to lead the way. I convinced my mom that we needed to move out of Hollywood and into Burbank. She obsessed about the money it would cost, and so did my stepfather, George. Like most Scientologists, he cared more about working toward his eternity. Everything else was just materialistic and a waste of time. But I got to Mom one day when I said, "You know, LRH had very nice things, Mom. We need to live better." I knew this would appeal to her. So we moved into Park Point, an apartment complex. Mario Lopez and Jennifer Love Hewitt were a couple of our neighbors. Standing on our balcony overlooking the pool downstairs in the center of the courtyard, I thought, "We made it, people. We're living in Burbank, California." Shortly before our move, Nicole had decided to move out on her own. She got an apartment nearby. Ever since we'd left Clearwater, my sister's interest in Scientology had waned. As the years passed, she left the church and moved toward Christianity. I didn't have a problem with it, but my mother did. She attributed anything that was wrong in my sister's life, everyday problems like money issues or boyfriend trouble, to the fact that Nicole was no longer a Scientologist. Looking back, I should have pointed out, "Wait, we have the same exact problems, and we are still in Scientology." At the time, however, I was under the impression that our achievements in the church outweighed anything else that might be going wrong in our real lives, or any other non-Scientologist lives, for that matter. Still, I never gave Nicole a hard time about no longer being in the church. In September of 1989, when the first episode of Living Dolls aired, it seemed like everything was going my way. Life was exciting, from the telex I received from then-ABC President Bob Iger telling me to have a good show, to coming to the attention of the new kids on the block. Well, I wasn't exactly the one who got noticed by the hottest boy band at the time,